Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy, and I'm here with Phil Beecher, President and CEO of the Y-Sun Alliance. Today, we're going to talk about the challenge of IoT at scale. Phil, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Ian. Pleasure to be here.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself and the Y-Sun Alliance before we start?
My background is engineering. I graduated a very long time ago in electronics and electrical engineering. Since then, most of my work has been in communications, starting initially with cellular or GSM, and then moving more into IoT comms. So engineering background generally. I have worked in standardization in IEEE and some other organizations. And that's how I got into the Y-Sun Alliance. We did some development of radio specification for large-scale peer-to-peer communication networks, particularly for IoT and smart grid-type applications. And at the end of that standard development, a number of the stakeholders decided to form an industry alliance so we could take it to the next level. As you're probably aware, standards does not actually deliver interoperable solutions. The utility industry wanted a choice of vendors and to know that there would be a longevity in the technology they were using.
I find it interesting that the utility industry wanted to lay standards down, because after all, they stand to benefit quite a lot from large-scale public IoT, particularly given the number of touch points they have across their networks, be that meters at home, water, gas, electric. What did they bring to you when they said this is what we want and how we want it?
If we go back a little bit, this was around 2006. There was an effort within the US electrical utilities particularly to develop technology that would improve the resilience of smart grid. This was the ability to deal with situations like hurricanes, different outage management scenarios. There have been a number of utilities that use cellular systems for doing meter reading, and a couple of problems with them. First problem really is that the cellular industry wants to update everything every 2 to 3 years. And if you're putting a smart meter system out there, you want it to last for 10 to 20 years. So utilities were particularly interested in having control over that technology so they could basically evolve at the pace they wanted. The other problem with cellular, or one of the problems, is that you don't get ubiquitous coverage. If you're Pacific Gas and Electric in the San Francisco Bay Area deploying 4 million smart meters, you want connectivity to all of those meters, not just 95% of them. We did some work on the standardization to provide a radio technology that allowed peer-to-peer connectivity, which means that the network can then build itself in the way it wants to, and it can be resilient to any faults that might appear or any interference that occurs in there. Going back to your original question, there were two utilities who were very instrumental in the development of the standard. That was Pacific Gas and Electric and Florida Power and Light, both of whom were deploying fairly large proprietary wireless mesh networks for their smart meter infrastructure. They didn't want to be locked into a single vendor, so they initiated the standardization effort.
What is interesting about that is that when you look at those large utilities, they've understood the need for IoT at their substations and every other touch point on their network. It's how they're regulated and understand the flows. The problem they've had with the older technology is not just that they need it to last for long periods of time, but it's been insecure. It's out of their control. We've often got control boxes in the middle of nowhere, and they are worried that these could be tampered with or attacked in the current climate. What did they bring as a requirement for security to you?
That's a big question because, as you touched on, there are a number of different aspects to all of this. Number one, if you're using wireless communications, then you have an inherent problem with, or possible problem with, security anyway, in that you don't have wires that you can physically protect. One of the parts of the technology we use is frequency hopping. The method that we use within the WiSUN technology is a decentralized method. Therefore, every meter on the network frequency hops on its own pattern, and its neighbors discover those patterns and then can find their neighbor and communicate with their neighbor. As part of that, we have channel avoidance. If there is a channel that's with interference, which could come as either a malevolent intent or just radio interference, then that channel can be avoided. So there's this dynamic adjustment of the channels. So that's one thing there. Another thing, as you mentioned, devices are out in the field, so they can be tampered. There's a couple of strategies for mitigation. With the WiSUN field area network technology, we use certificate-based security in every device. So that's typically accompanied by firmware signing. When a device attempts to join the network, it's validated against an authentication server that that device is allowed to join the network, that it hasn't had its firmware tampered with as part of that firmware signing. And if there's anything wrong with that device, then it's just not allowed to join the network. So that's part of that. Most devices, as you're probably aware, if you have certificate-based security, you still need a private key. Our member companies, certainly nowadays, mostly are using hardware secure elements in their devices. But we also have a number using physically unclonable functionality, where you can actually retrofit that, and that relies on the characteristics of the semiconductors in the device uniquely establishing a pattern when they power up.
I'll come back to that retrofit in a minute, because that's a really interesting challenge that a lot of IoT is failing with badly. When we're out in the middle of nowhere, we can hop around channels without any worries whatsoever. Once we start to get near airports, built-up areas, cities, industrial areas, the amount of electronic pollution in the air is phenomenal. How do you balance that out? Do you reduce the size of the mesh to a specific grid size? Or what's been done to ensure that you can find clear channels?
We're using ISM band, which is freely available to all. That's possibly unusual and surprising for people. But depending on where you are in the world, there's a certain bandwidth availability. We are using sub-gigahertz frequencies, so we're immediately avoiding that part of the spectrum that's used by Bluetooth and Wi-Fi, which obviously provides heavy congestion. There is quite a lot of spectrum available. The modulation technologies we use, and there's a couple there, provide for a good interference mitigation scenario. Plus, there's adaptive power control that is used so that you minimize the amount of bandwidth or the spatial bandwidth that you're using. What you can actually get is very large networks. For example, in Tokyo, Tokyo Electric Power has around 29 million smart meters across the greater Tokyo area, mostly using a frequency hopping wireless mesh technology.
We're seeing other industries coming in and struggling with this idea of wireless and control. For example, healthcare. We can't always wire up hospitals. In fact, modern hospitals aren't necessarily built for machines to be wired. They want them to be wireless. But now they're having to deal with patients bringing in their own devices and a vast number of devices in a very small space. Is there any applicability from what you're doing that would then apply to something like a hospital scenario?
Yes. The IoT space is very big. There are lots of different types of IoT. Medical equipment is fairly specific in terms of its resilience and reliability that's needed. Using frequencies that are not usually public available is probably the starting point for medical technology. But also, as I mentioned, some of the things that we're doing with WiSUN in terms of adaptive power control, so minimizing the space, using modulation that has quite high coding gain so you can reduce interference. There are technologies that will make this feasible. I'm actually still involved in IEEE 802, And there are a number of activities going on right now in things like local area networking for medical applications. So watch this space.
I said I'd return to the retrofit question. One of the challenges we have with industrial IoT, particularly around the utilities, water, gas, electric, is the age of the equipment in their networks. A lot of that equipment was never designed to be retrofitted with new features. In fact, a lot of it wasn't even designed with security as part of the initial planning, and that causes specific problems when they're trying to then secure this equipment. How did the early need for retrofit get raised within the Wi-SUN Alliance and the work that you are doing with the two utilities?
It was right at the very beginning of the development program to provide a radio technology that would allow over-the-air upgrades. As you're aware, nothing is 100% solid from the day it's first deployed. The ability to upload firmware revisions, whether they're to fix bugs in the application or whether it's to fix a security hole, that's a major importance in what we did with Wi-SUN. I think it's worth commenting that this work started with two utility companies, but Wi-SUN now has 350 member companies, over 46 different countries, and we're being adopted fairly large scale for the utility industry. Initially electrical, and then more recently, and you mentioned water and gas as well. And certainly things like the water industry. Certainly in the UK, we still have a problem with leaks. There is a lot of aging infrastructure that could benefit with renovation.
It's fascinating in the UK to see the pressure from the water utilities to get households to fit smart meters so they can see how much water those households consume. By the most conservative estimate, something like 40, 50, even more of the leakage is done in the utility's own network. When they talk with you about deploying this technology, are they still focused purely on meters at the home of individuals or businesses? Or are they now talking about this throughout their entire network so they can really hone in on where their leakage problems are?
The latter. Certainly with water systems, there's a growing idea about smart water. Not only do you meter individual premises, but you have sensors on the water distribution network, then you can actually work out where the water losses are occurring. The idea of a smart water meter is probably not doing one meter read every 3 months, but doing something every day or two or three times a day, maybe. And then you can focus where there is leakage and loss. It's a similar concept with loss management in the electrical utility network as well. So if you know how much you're pushing out there from a substation and you know how much everybody is allegedly using, then you can detect where those losses are. The same thing works for water and gas. Leakage detection on a gas meter network is potentially more dangerous than it is on a water network.
One of the things we have on the electrical network in the UK, for example, is first generation smart meters. As those people have moved to EV, they want to put solar on the roof and move electricity back to the grid. They like the idea of bi-directional movement of electricity, but they're lost until their meters can be retrofitted. I'm intrigued. The retrofit conversation we had just now. What would prevent the retrofitting? Is it an issue of the physical design of the meter? Or is it a case of not the right protocols or software inside the meters?
That's a really good question, and I'm afraid I don't know the answer to that. I would say that there could be physical restrictions within the meters in terms of the size of the code that you need to run a more sophisticated protocol. That's a possibility, but I don't know. I have trouble answering that. It's somewhat surprising. I'm English. I live in the UK. Most of the work I do in smart metering is global, and the technology that we do in Wi-SUN is deployed in North and Latin America, across parts of Asia, particularly in Japan, Korea, Taiwan, for example, as well as other parts of Southeast Asia. There is not so much deployed in the UK.
Is Europe the same as the UK? Is Europe also slightly lagging behind America and Asia?
To some extent, yes. If you look at countries like France, Spain, Italy, they've had smart meter reading systems for quite a long time that work very well for them. Up until recently, there hasn't been an energy supply problem. So the idea of needing to optimize energy usage hasn't been quite so much of a problem as now it's become. I think we will see progress in using different technologies, using different network topologies for smart metering, as you touched on, the inclusion of EV charging, but also the inclusion of renewables in the grid means that you need much more flexibility. Having centralized data collection and management, that is what you need for electricity billing, that needs to become more flexible to manage a grid that incorporates solar and wind generation particularly.
That billing question is interesting. We've had Economy 7 in the UK for a long time, even though it's not used by a lot of people these days. Then we've got a more traditional tariff. But we're moving into a time where we see extreme pressure on electricity grids because of what's happening in Ukraine and the cost of oil and gas. Do you see electricity companies around the world starting to take a more granular view of electric usage and say, OK, let's say we have 5 blocks of time throughout the day where we see different usage patterns. We want to better control the usage in the afternoon block, the early tea block. Therefore, we're going to use that smart meter and feed it back to customers, maybe in the form of a more expensive tariff at that time, or in the way of better education. Is that something you're starting to see come along, or something perhaps that could be enabled by the technology?
Definitely. There have been a number of programs that support dynamic pricing initiatives. As you're probably aware, there are times when the peak load on the network is getting close to the generation capacity. Trying to smooth out those peaks and troughs is really important to the utility companies. So depending on where you are in the world and depending on people's reactions and how they deal with this, there will be a different incentive scheme to do this. For example, in the US, in California, quite a lot of energy is used by swimming pool pumping systems. Pacific Gas and Electric put a program in that if you allowed them to remotely control your swimming pool pump, then they would give you a financial incentive to do so. That was one of the very early load balancing activities of utilities. That's definitely something that is becoming probably more prevalent.
It's a whole interesting approach, isn't it? Most of us think about IoT just for monitoring. It tells us what's going on, what we're monitoring, where we're monitoring it from, what the flow rates are. Once we turn that on its head and use it as a control technology, not for what we own as a utility, but what the customer owns, it becomes really interesting. But it also raises questions about the scope of the APIs, the software, the protocols that we have in use. You talked earlier about the number of countries and the number of companies that are now involved with the Wise Sun Alliance. What does that bring in terms of the equipment and the business opportunities looking forwards?
That's another big question with potentially a lot of answers. What we've tried to do with Wise Sun Alliance is get the industry to agree a standards-based interoperable communications technology that provides effectively the internet for the Internet of Things. The technology, there's been a lot of work by a lot of people gone into this. The development effort is quite large. If you are a small company, then the benefit of having Wise Sun is that you don't have to develop that comms technology or the communication module because you can go and buy it from another Wise Sun member company. And there are several of those. There is competition in that environment. This means that you can have companies that have very good ideas on how to optimize energy usage or how to do things like storm management. One of the great use cases for smart grid is things like outage management, where you have hurricanes and they take out great chunks of the grid. being able to monitor that and reconnect the grid infrastructure remotely and in most cases automatically to avoid the fault area or to reduce that area of fault is a really important part of this. But the companies that are making those sort of devices are not making hundreds of millions of devices. They don't want to invest too heavily in the development of their own proprietary comms. So they come to a WISUM member, buy a commercial module for a few dollars or a few pounds that just fits into their product, and then it integrates into a wider grid.
If I look at some of those companies out there who we wouldn't see as a utility, let's take washing machine vendors or people who are producing the current generation of lawnmowers. A number of those have got deals with SIM vendors to put SIMs inside their devices. It allows them to have remote information sent back to them. They're not going with straight connect to the house Wi-Fi and send it back. They go device to device.
Right.
Thinking back to that conversation about controlling swimming pools, are you seeing those conversations from those device manufacturers with the utility vendors or with yourselves to see how you can expand the reach of your protocol to provide that greater level of management and understanding? If you can see those little peaks caused by people turning on their washing machines, can you then jump in and control them and say, don't go until midnight or one in the morning? Because that levels out the load on grids.
I guess that is the same sort of idea as the swimming pool pump. With swimming pool pumps, you have to run the pump for a certain number of hours every 24-hour period. So you can do that load shifting quite nicely on that. Washing machines, people can put timers on them. I haven't seen the washing machine situation. We have a very big program in Japan, which came about as a result of the Fukushima incident, where Japan went from energy surplus to energy deficit almost overnight. The country wanted to shut down its nuclear. So there was a home energy management program, first initiated by Tokyo Electric Power, and then adopted across all of the Japanese utilities. This was a mechanism where people could have an in-home display that monitored their energy usage and then allowed them to adjust their own usage to fit with a specific pattern. In Japan, that works fine because there is a general social attitude that the users will do things that benefit the community. That's not necessarily the case everywhere in the world. Sometimes there needs to be a financial incentive to it as well.
One of the things I hear around smart meters regularly is that rollout is delayed due to a lack of equipment. You talked about the number of vendors that have joined the WISUM Alliance. How long do you think it's going to be for most countries to get a majority of electric to the home onto smart meters? How much urgency is there now, given the current political climate from last year, to driving smart meters to gain a better understanding and control of the grids?
Oh, there are a number of factors in that. And again, it's a very wide question because different parts of the world are very different in their requirements. If you look at the Europe situation, it's certainly come to people's focus very quickly that we need to do something about optimizing energy usage. I think there will be a drive, certainly in Europe, to do that. In other parts of the world, climate change is having a serious effect on the reliability and the resilience of grid and power distribution. In WISUM Alliance, we're seeing very strong drive for Latin America, also from India as well. India is in a position where a large number of potential users aren't even connected to the grid. And where they are, they have unreliable power. So India has got a smart grid rollout program, something around 250 million smart meters that they've started on that deployment. So different places, different needs, I think. But ultimately, it's all about improving energy supply to the customer and improving efficiencies in the network.
In the opening comments, you said that you've been involved in standards bodies for a long time. I've been monitoring standards bodies since the 80s, particularly around technology. I think it's fair to say the standards bodies don't generally move quickly.
Correct.
Glacial is often the phrase I hear.
Yep.
And even that would imply speed. How do you drive better adoption of what you're doing with the YSUN Alliance. How do you drive greater adoption of new components or new elements of your protocol in such a way as to get the benefits into the market quickly, especially as we look at the scale now of some of those IoT deployments?
When we first started, there was a lot of corporate vested interests in making it difficult to deliver interoperability.
I'm shocked.
I know. In IoT, to some extent, that's still there. But with YSUN Alliance, we've basically gone over the top of that hill now. And it's become accepted that the communications technology will be interoperable. Within YSUN, we don't develop standards. We work within the standards organizations, whether it's IEEE or IETF. Then we try and take the best of what standards are available and put them together in a way that makes sense for the sort of market that we're working with. Therefore, it took a long time to initiate this. But now we're there, we're moving along, we're adopting new technologies as they're formed. There is definitely a will, and you see this particularly in IETF right now, where there is a lot of work going on in Internet of Things type technologies, whether that's improved routing protocols, so you can interconnect more devices with lower latencies, or improved security protocols. And all of that is being developed at quite a pace. Within YSUN, if we notice any gaps in the standards, then our members will go back into those standards organizations and help develop them. And there's a definite will to deliver quickly.
One of the challenges that gathering all this data brings is data storage. We talk regularly about the amount of data that enterprises gather, but we don't always refine that down to the amount of data that's being thrown up by the increase in IoT. When you're planning your protocols, how much emphasis was put on packet size, on frequency of transmission, on collection of data, on correlation of data, on long-term storage? Because the latter is heavily impacted by regulators around the world.
Good question again, with lots of separate answers to this. One of the early requirements was to be able to carry IPv6 frames within the YSUN physical and medium access control layer. So we can run IPv6 all the way to each end node on the network. We have flexible data rates, starting fairly slow, but moving up to relatively fast. So you can move quite large amounts of data over the network, should you wish to do so. However, I think what's happening a lot in the industry now is more about edge computing. So rather than, because you mentioned storage of data, but there's also the processing of the data. If you send large quantities of raw data over the network, what on earth are you going to do with it when it gets there? So much better to process the data near the edge of the network, take the useful information from that data and do stuff with it there. So again, an example of this in electric utilities is bulk VAR management. In other words, if you have complex loads at the edge of the network and you want to change the way the distribution network is delivering the power, then it doesn't make any sense to send it to a central location, process it, and then send that commands back down to the distribution network. Much better is that those end nodes could connect directly to the distribution network and share their data without it going through a central process. That's an example where manipulating the data locally, using it as short-term data, provides a benefit to the grid. It also overcomes the problem of privacy, because the data reduces the privacy problem, because the data is transient. You basically use the data, process it, clean it, do something with it, and then you no longer need it. So that overcomes one of those problems. But fortunately for YSUN Alliance, we don't get involved in data storage as such. We're about moving it over the network as quickly as possible. So the considerations for user privacy, obviously we have to be aware of them, but we don't need to worry quite as much as the utility companies or the cloud storage providers, for example.
So normally about now on a podcast, I ask people for their top three things for those starting out and maybe planning something. I'm going to turn that around a little here. If you were to be starting again with Weiss & Alliance and working with utilities on planning this massive scale of IoT, what would you change? What would your new priorities be?
I think the priorities would probably remain the same, actually. I think the technology we've been working on and continue to work on, obviously technology doesn't stand still. I'm still working in this field and still enjoying it and still excited by it. One of the things I would change is I would certainly drive the standardization effort harder than I did at the time. I think I was too kind to some of the participants, which I probably wouldn't be. I was a lot younger then, so now I'm probably losing the patience that I had. I think that would probably be the big thing. I think it's really important to engage the stakeholders, the end users in all of these activities, whether that's the utilities or the utility customers as well. It's ultimately those are the people that know what they need to get out of this and what the benefits should be.
I mean, we've had peaks and troughs in prices, raw commodities, such as gas and oil over the years, and even the issue of cleaning water in certain parts of the world. But I think the last year has focused a lot of people's attention on the need to do better.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Phil, thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the conversation.